This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Kate Wilson. She's the founder and managing director of Nosy Crow. Nosy Crow is a new publisher based in England, publishing children's books and apps. How are you, Kate?
I'm very well, thank you. It's good to speak to you.
You as well. Well, I'm interested in talking to you on a number of points, but I really thought it'd be a good idea for you to, for a lot of people who may not know what you're doing, to talk a little bit about Nosy Crow, what your intention is, and how you decided to do this.
Okay. Well, I've worked in publishing for a quarter of a century, which is a terrible admission, really. And my background's really a mix of international selling, so selling rights in books, and then a quite early specialization in children's books. And I ran Macmillan Children's Books in the UK for about 10 years, and then I ran Scholastic in the UK, so Scholastic's UK branch, for about 5 years. Then I went into adult publishing for, about 5 minutes, and that didn't really work out for me at all. And I discovered that I really loved children's books, and I was very attuned to them by then, and making that transition to adult books wasn't very palatable to me. I discovered leaving children's books made me think a lot about what I valued about children's books. I valued that way that as a children's book publisher, you are always having to think about somebody who is not you, who is an audience that is other than you. And I found that when I went into adult publishing, there's quite a lot of people publishing things that they liked to read themselves. And much as I love children's books, I don't always curl up with a copy of Goodnight Moon myself of an evening. So it was really important to me to think about another audience. I found that very exciting. And also that to get to that audience, you had to then go through a whole sequence of people, librarians, school teachers, parents. So the multiplicity of the appeal that you had to sort of strike meant that I felt that children's books was a particularly interesting bit of business to be involved in. I also found that it turned out I really, really, it sounds ridiculous, I really cared about literacy. I found that the underlying values that had been unspoken, really, in quite a lot of my career in children's publishing were quite challenged by moving to adult publishing. And I realized how important it was for me to be involved in children's books and how important I felt reading for pleasure was and children's literacy was. And so I decided to set up a children's publishing company that very much had the child's reading experience at its heart. So while it would be lovely if we get great reviews, and it would be lovely if we got wonderful prizes and awards for our book publishing, what I'm really interested in doing is publishing books and apps that genuinely appeal to children. And I'm not terribly judgmental about what children read. If there is a divide between literature on the one hand and literacy on the other hand, and some people do view, I think, the children's discussion about reading as going along a kind of spectrum with literacy on one end and literature on the other end. I'm very much on the literacy end of that spectrum. I don't really mind what they're decoding as long as they are reading. That's very important to me. So and they're getting pleasure from that. So I set up this company with that intention, and was able to gather around me from that 25 years of publishing a group of people who I felt shared those values and shared those interests. And we set up we announced our existence 18 months ago, so in February 2010, and we've been publishing since January. We published our first book in January and published our first app in February of 2011, so just a few months ago.
And I know you're publishing, interestingly, I noticed that you're not specializing in a particular age group. You're covering the complete spectrum from very early readers through what, now I hate this term, I've always thought it was a misnomer, but young adult.
I suppose that's true. We start at zero, and our first books would be board books for children younger than one, I would say. They've got touch and feel elements, and so they're very much inviting children into the sort of sensory world, I suppose, of books. The book is a physical object. And then at the other end, we'd have, I would say, very quite innocent young adult fiction. So books that I would be very comfortable with my own children reading. My oldest child is 12, my oldest daughter's 12. And I think that for me, 11 or 12 is really sort of our cutoff. Small Blue Thing, which is our oldest fiction title, would, I think, be perfectly readable by somebody who was 14 or 15. And there are certainly 14, 15-year-old readers of that book. But I think our heartland is sort of 0 to 12. 0 to 11, I think, almost in the UK. In the UK, children change from primary school to secondary school. I never know how this works in the US. You'd think, having worked for Scholastic, I'd know. But primary school is, I think, maybe what you call elementary, and I think secondary school is sort of the equivalent of junior high. We move in the UK from schools that have maybe 200 children on average to schools that have 1,000 or more children on average. It's a very, very major transition at 11. And it is the point at which I felt that children become very, very significantly much more independent readers, assuming they are reading, and one hopes they are. So I felt that what we wanted to be was, in addition to being child-friendly, we also wanted to be quite parent-friendly, and we wanted to use social media in lots of ways to connect with parents, and that's something that I think we're doing pretty effectively. I do feel that you are selling children's books to adults if you're selling books for kids of 12 and younger. And I think at the point when you're selling books for children or young adults of 12 and above, you really are having to address them. And that felt to me like a different sort of exercise, and not one that I was as interested in addressing as I am in addressing that 0 to 11.
No, that makes, I think that actually makes a great deal of sense. I think you're right that, and I hadn't thought of it as in quite those black and white terms, but literally you are, up to a certain point, it's the parents who are going to have control over the reading experience to a great extent.
Yes.
So in this context, I know you set out from the beginning to do books and apps. It's on your website. It's also, I think, the first thing that many people in the United States heard about you was Little Pigs, the first app you did in February, which I think is a terrific app. And I think it's, I do think they're not out of range for what children's book publishing has done for many, many years. You know, there have been board books which have, moving parts. There's paper, paper engineered books, which are literally almost the equivalent of an app just made out of paper. And some of them have music and sound because you can, with the chips now, you can press buttons.
Mm.
Obviously, the app, I know when I watched the trailer that you did for Three Little Pigs, and I thought it was interesting to see the children interacting with the device. And that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about anyway. Because, you've said children-centered, and I wondered if you did, have you done actual research on how children interact with the device? I mean, it's obviously, the iPad is a new device, so there would be difficult to have a lot of extensive research, but I'm just curious to know what you've done in terms of not only the making of the app, but the kind of the framework of your thinking about how you make apps.
I think the first thing to say is that we're very clear about the kind of apps that we want to do. You talked, and I think you're completely right, about the value of some of the things that we do as children's publishers in the world of the app. And what I was particularly interested in, what I am particularly interested in, is the app as a reading experience. None of our apps, I can't imagine being in a position where our apps don't have text in them. I can't imagine them not having a voice audio component. I can't imagine they're not being text to read, if you like. So creating apps that were reading experiences was important to us. And you've made a very interesting point, too, about talking about novelty books, by which I mean touch and feel books or pull tab books or pop-up books. I find that the part of... I love those kinds of books, actually. I mean, I love all children's books. But I really also... I've found it particularly creatively satisfying myself being involved in novelty books. I think because I'm not an illustrator, and though I do write, I'm not really a writer, but I am quite interested in creative concepts. And I found that it is the part of my brain that I used when I was thinking up novelty books that I use when I am thinking about apps and app creation. It's the same way of thinking. So I think that there is a real transferability of those
skills. Yeah, no, I think that's right.
You asked You asked about research, and the answer is there isn't a lot of research. We look for online research all the time, but a lot of that online research at the moment is market orientated. It's saying, you know, how many moms pass back their iPhone in a car to children. You know, so we have some data about how parents are using iPhones, and that's research that we either pay for or that's available to anyone who knows how to Google. I've talked to a couple of researchers. There's a research company here called Aardvark that's done quite a lot of research on how parents are using screens with children. So we talked to them, and I've spoken with them on various panels and various discussion groups. And otherwise, we are parents who are ourselves watching our children interacting with screens and making the kinds of inconsistent, constantly moving decisions about how we want children to interact with screens that any other parents are. So I'd have to say quite a lot of it is personal and is just about what I feel is right. But publishing has never been a business that's been tremendously grounded on sort of big R&D budgets and people going out and working out whether or not people are going to respond to a particular book one way or another. And I would say that I feel confident enough of the integrity of what we're doing in terms of the apps not to feel that they're harmful, and to feel pretty confident that what we're doing is beneficial. We're not pretending that they have any sort of pedagogical value. We're not saying if you constant exposure to Three Little Pigs will mean that you can read after 3 months. We're not pretending that it's a learning experience. And I think it's very interesting that a number of people, when they're talking about apps, have very high expectations of their educational value. I think that's a fascinating thing. It feels almost like the beginning of the children's book business, where, you know, I'm thinking about sort of, you know, 18th, 19th century books, where people expected that children's books had to be good for you. And if they were not good for you in some, you know, really, really clear moral way, educational way, they were not worthy. And I think we've moved on from that in terms of print books. And it's very interesting to me to see the same debate almost rising up around apps. We're not pretending, as I say, that they are anything other than good, worthwhile, repeatable entertainment as a reading experience. And so, that's what we're aiming to do on print and on.
Well, and print. I want to talk about print too, but just because we're talking about the app and the platforms that it runs on, I know so far you're running on iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch.
Yes.
Now, is that a big enough market for an app for you as a business? Do you worry about, obviously everybody worries about the size of the market, but here people talk about the penetration of the iPad, the number of iPhones, the number of iPods, and it's a pretty big number, I think. So the question is, can you get enough people to buy an app to play on their devices and hand them to their children? I'm not asking you to divulge your sales figures, but I'm just curious because I know apps can be expensive to make.
And our apps are very expensive to make. They're very, they're very high quality, I think, and we were clear about that. They're also relatively high priced within the app environment, and I was very clear I didn't really want to be doing, kind of 99-cent apps because I don't think that's helpful to anyone. I don't think you can come up with anything that's particularly interesting in that area at the moment. So, the answer to your question is nobody knows. And we're still at a very, very early stage in the development of this. We're very happy with how sales are going. And we've also sold rights in the apps to France, to Gallimard Jeunesse, who are the publisher of lots of things, Harry Potter, for example, in France, and to Carlsen in Germany, who are the publishers of Harry Potter, actually, and Stephanie Meyer and various other people in Germany. So sort of fairly major, we've almost fairly major, as it happens, partners in those countries. And that means it's sort of working in the same way. And some other novelty book kind of question. When British publishers, and they always have for years and years, make a novelty book, let's say a pop-up, pirate ship, let's call it a pirate ship for now, we can construct this marvellous, marvellous piece of paper engineering. And the UK market itself is not big enough for us to be able to make that publication financially viable. So what we do is we go out to the rest of the world and we ask them if they would like a better pirate ship than they could make if they were making one themselves, and say that we will make one for them. And I guess that experience of international rights dealing led me to think in a particular way about how we might make apps. And selling France and Germany is just the beginning of what I think we will do with our apps. So we'll find ways of supplementing our revenue from our own English language sales by having some rights sales too. And between those things, we think that we have a workable business model. But ask me in 3 years, because this was an exciting area to be experimenting in, and no one knows the
answer. Well, so I guess, no, that's actually, that's the model that many illustrated book publishers use. Toshin famously, publish for multiple
Absolutely.
Languages, all markets. And I think that's really smart.
Yep.
I guess one of the questions, having had some experience in the past with children's books, the question that everybody always asks is, will this travel? It seems like it's easier for the younger ages. It's the universality level is higher. As you get older, I noticed, the YA that you were talking about, this sort of 12-year-old age, it's set in, near the Thames River, let's say. So you'd have to, it's much harder to make that book possible for an American audience.
Yes. I mean, obviously, that's not a book we'd consider making an app of, because I think an app of that would have to be almost like a feature film, or a huge, huge computer game. It would be to do something genuinely interactive that really used a feature of the touchscreen device. And wasn't an iBook, which is a perfectly legitimate thing for it to be. I'm not suggesting it won't be an iBook. Indeed, it will. But to make something that was an app based on that book would require something really, really hugely ambitious. I think that there's a whole set of reasons why I wouldn't be interested in tackling fiction, by which I mean chapter books and older novels, in app form. I also think that as a British publisher, because we're used to dealing with the fact that our market is a sixth of the size of the US market, if that, we are always thinking, when we're doing illustrated books, about the rest of the world. It's a sort of funny bit of your brain that you develop, and you don't almost know you've done it. But, it's a sort of alert that goes off in your head any time, I don't know, like somebody says, oh, kids love rescue vehicles, which is true. Kids love fire engines and they love ambulances and they love police cars. And there's immediately a bit in my head that goes off, the sort of alarm bell that says, yes, but police cars don't look the same
That's right.
way around the world, and neither do fire trucks, and they're not even called the same thing. And the wheels are on different sides of them if you're looking at the UK versus the US, and a whole set of issues are going to be kind of brought to the fore if that's what happens. And therefore, I will have to accommodate that when I am thinking about the nature of the illustration or the nature of the illustrator. And I will have to be thinking about what I include and what I can't include in a book on this theme. Nobody can dial for emergency services, for example, because the number is completely different in every country. Nobody can be seen to be doing that. I must never have color type that says 911 or 999 in the UK. There's just stuff I know. And the fire truck must never be, I used to say, that my nightmare book is the one where the boy looks out of the window in his terraced house, which is very UK-looking, and sees the milk delivery truck come along the road with the guy driving on the wrong side of the road, and crashes into a red pillar box because he is swerving to avoid a hedgehog. Now, and dials 911 and saves the day. 999 and saves the day. And of course, none of those things pertain in the US. You don't, I believe, even have very many hedgehogs, which seems to me a tragedy for you. But I think that as soon as I hear of those things, I'm very alerted to those issues. And that sort of sensibility that then informs how I look at everything, artwork, for example. That sounds very arrogant, but to some degree, I can look at a piece of art and say, I think that will sell in the UK and Germany and the US, but will not sell in France. I think that this piece of artwork will sell in Holland and France, but will not sell in board book form in Germany. You just know. 25 years is a long time, and you just know. So when we're thinking about apps and books, we're always thinking about that translatability and that issue of traveling when we're looking at things that cost a lot to make. Now, costing a lot to make is a thing that covers both illustrated books and also apps. In the case of novels, what was interesting in contrast about that novel that you talked about, Small Blue Thing, which, as you say, is a paranormal fantasy of a twilighty kind, ghosts, not vampires, memories, not blood, but otherwise, you know, not wildly off, was that for a UK audience, we had growing used to having to have a US experience when we were reading romantic fantasy. And I felt that there was room, and indeed it proved that there was room, for something that had a specifically UK setting.
No, that's interesting too.
So we actually used, you know, one of the things that was the thing that was attractive to me about that book was it was a paranormal fantasy, but it was not set in America.
Right. I wonder how well the Americans will. I think Americans tend to be fairly provincial in that way too. It's easier, I think, for the rest of the world to experience America than it is for America to experience the rest of the world.
Well, you say that, except that I think that there are certain things, and romantic fantasy is not one of them, but there are certain things that have historically crossed particularly brilliantly from the UK to the US. And children's fantasy, middle grade mm-hmm. fantasy, of which Harry Potter is, of course, the best of all possible examples, middle grade fantasy has translated very well. Middle grade real life doesn't translate at all. We need to have it from the US. We need to have Wimpy Kid from the US. You're never going to want to have Jacqueline Wilson in the US. You're just not. Funny, real life, funny or sad, in fact, real life stuff only travels one way.
I think that's,
and it travels from the US.
I think that's actually similar. Well, we don't have to talk about this, but I think it's similarly true for adult. Certain things travel from the US to America, I mean, from UK to America, and work perfectly, but many things will not.
I think that adult literary fiction is something that goes kind of both ways. I'm interested to see how much women's commercial fiction actually works UK to US. So I'm thinking about Shopaholic and things like that. I think, you know, women's commercial sort of chick lit stuff. And historical fiction. Obviously, you still, in some wonderful, lovely, romantic way, you still believe that we wander around wearing wimple headdresses.
And we also, people want to, there's no end to reading about Arthur and Avalon and Morgan Le Fay.
Exactly. So that Arthur, Avalon, I'd also say, wives of Henry VIII. Can't get enough of them in America.
That's true.
Fantastic. Love it. It's an export industry.
So let me ask you I did want to ask one more thing about the apps, because this is really important too.
Mm-hmm.
Apps, the biggest problem that most people I talk to say about apps is the difficulty in discovery, search, and how do you get people to know that your app, your wonderful app, your beautiful app, will even be discovered out of the 450,000 apps that exist in the in the App Store now. So, and of mm-hmm. course, when you sell rights to the app to other countries, I immediately think, well, mm-hmm. that problem goes to the publisher there, and each country has its own issues. You have to figure out how to market it. But I'm suspecting that the answer is you still have to do everything you need to do for a book, which is to let people know that it exists.
Yes. I mean, I would say there's a very interesting phenomenon in terms of the apps, which is that that The Three Little Pigs, which has already been published in Germany in German, was immediately on that app of the week, the rolling image that you get at the big banner that you get at the front of the iPad store, the iPad app store. And I think that's very interesting. And I think the reason that the German because it's of course chosen by the Apple's German team to be that, was because there was nothing in German that was that exciting, because the costs of creating it were high, and Germany couldn't itself I think it would have been hard for a German publishing company certainly to have created that reading experience on its own, in the same way that they tend to look to the UK to create.
Well, and what you're saying, of course, and I think that this has got to be true, if it's really good, then you will get especially, you know, the Apple environment itself supports quality. It, you know, the quality is going to win.
Well, I think you're right. I think there's two things you can do. The first thing is to be lucky enough or have created a good enough app for Apple itself, for the Apple team to choose to promote that app. And promoting that app means having it as app of the week if you're extraordinarily lucky, having it in new and noteworthy, having it in what's hot in books. You know, all of these things are hugely, hugely important and increase discoverability because it's just so hard to sift down within Apple. Now, the interesting thing about that for a small developer, as we of course are, is that unlike bookshop space, you can't buy that space from Apple. Apple itself has to decide that that is something it is going to give
to you. That's right, but it also that maintains their credibility.
It maintains their credibility and makes it a much more even playing field in some ways than, say, the traditional book selling space is for publishers. So I think that's a very interesting thing for us. And so we're thinking a lot, of course, about trying to decode why it is that Apple liked particular things about our app. And the more they like things about your app, the more likely they are to want to talk to you, of course. So it's at a sort of positive spiral of some level of relationship with Apple, and that's where we happily are. So that's one important thing that can happen as a result of this. I think the second thing that happens is that you talk about it. I mean, in just the same, it's very much a PR sort of based space. So you're constantly talking about it, and you're talking about it through social media a lot of the time and to bloggers, specialist bloggers. Because I think one of the exciting things to me as a publisher is that while in the past my experience was very much that there was always a lovely intermediary between me and my ultimate reader or customer, at least, in the form of the bookseller. In Apple land, I'm very directly in touch with those customers, and we have a thing at the end of the app where you are asked if you want to comment on the app. We say it's our first one, and if you want to let us know, that would be terrific. We've had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds now. I mean, I guess maybe thousands now of comments on the app. Because and in a way that people can't tell us. People may love our books, but they don't tell us that, or it's harder for them to tell us that. And so I think there's something very interesting about the immediacy of that relationship that we can have with individual readers and users. And then we also use Twitter and Facebook and, as I say, our own website, www.nosycrow.com, as a kind of space to connect with people and to talk to people and to inform people about what we're doing. So that's
Well, you've given me a great opening to ask what is, I think, another important question, which, you know, as this will sort of date this conversation, but only yesterday, Pottermore is announced as a direct-to-consumer e-publishing venue for Harry Potter. So... And yes. Of course, that is, you know, I'm very curious to know what people, other publishers think of that. Does it give you I know booksellers and librarians may be a little concerned. It seems to portend the possibility of, even greater change in the relationships, as you were talking about, with intermediaries. What are their roles? You know, if Harry Potter can go direct to readers, what's to prevent others from doing the same?
Well, I mean, I think an obvious answer is Harry Potter is Harry Potter, and not everything is. I mean, I did a blog post about this, actually, and I described, I said, is J.K. Rowling, are J.K. Rowling and Stephanie Meyer kind of black swans that are extraordinary events that we rationalize with hindsight? Or are they evidence, in fact, of the industry's constant ability to reinvent itself and rework itself? I think that's a very interesting question. I think there's two things to say. One, J.K. Rowling is J.K. Rowling. And two, J.K. Rowling is J.K. Rowling at this moment in time. And now, of course, no publisher is buying rights to a book without having ebook rights. I mean, Twilight's actually it's looking at the difference between J.K. Rowling and Stephanie Meyer is a very interesting one, because the Stephanie Meyer package included ebook rights when the publisher bought them, because nobody thought about ebook rights at the time that Bloomsbury, for it was Bloomsbury to begin with, bought J.K. Rowling, it wasn't a factor in the conversation. So the idea that any publisher who acquires a book and has built it in print form would not now have ebook rights, I think that feels like something that I can't quite imagine. So that's one thing to say about the specifics of that. So I think that it's a very, I guess I'm saying here, I think it's quite an isolated instance, both in terms of the extraordinary phenomenon of that franchise and also the extraordinary timing of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something kind of interesting about that. I think the second thing to say is that it does make all of these things make us think about, I think, have to make us think about what our role is as a publisher. And I talk about this quite a lot. I'm asked to talk about this quite a lot because moving from a very large-scale company to running a small company gave me a chance to think about what it was that I thought it was important for a publisher to be and do. And I thought a lot about the fact that publishers had historically invested in all sorts of things that arguably in a digital age weren't terribly necessary anymore. For example, huge amounts of stock and warehouses and people to move, put things in boxes and take things off conveyor belts and so on. And I think that obviously those things will go away, that investment that the publisher bought, the bankrolling of that is not so much a factor. Publishers do still invest in creativity. They do still invest in authors. And that often makes it possible for authors to have some time to spend creating. If we pay authors as publishers, they have time off from to take the risk. They're able to take the risk and create. And I think that that's an ongoing role that publishers still have in terms of investment. But I felt that just having a publisher as a bankroller was no longer enough as a role for a publisher. And I felt that it was tremendously important that we could say that we would be better at connecting with consumers than an individual was likely to be able to be. So when you come to Nosy Crow as an author, you are coming to, we've been publishing since January, so the numbers aren't huge, but, you know, kind of, I don't know, 2,500 Twitter followers and a very lively Facebook presence and, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of visitors to the website every day. So I think that we're able to offer a way of talking to consumers and to talking to influential consumers and influential opinion formers in a way that an author would have to start doing from scratch if they were a debut author. So I think that we can offer connection. I think the other thing I really feel we're offering is kind of shaping and creativity. I think unless we, you know, I don't buy books that are finished. I'm not really interested in buying books that are finished. I'm interested in buying books where the publisher's input adds value to whatever it is. And obviously that's the kind of sine qua non of that, almost the kind of sort of extreme example of that is the app, where as a publisher we are bringing together an illustrator, a coder, an animator, an author, if we're not writing them ourselves, the audio recording skills, audio voices that we've auditioned, composer with music. We sit at the centre of a kind of very collaborative activity, and I think increasingly publishers will have to say part of what they're able to do is to pull together various bits of creative input, and that's part of our role. I think the idea that what you do is you take something that's absolutely good to go and you slap a cover on it and whack it out into a chain bookstore and that's your job done is no longer going to be enough, because I think that it would be far too easy for us to be as publishers not to have a role. You have to decide how dare you interpose yourself between the reader and the author? The author's got stuff they want to write. The reader wants to read. Who are you to to occupy space between them, and what is the space that you can occupy that each of them will value? And I think that's a really fundamental question for publishers, and one that every day, I suppose, at Nozick-Crowe, we're trying to answer.
I think that is actually brilliant, and I have to say it's a perfect point to end the conversation. We've run out of time, but that was really a tremendous statement. I really like that. You've said some really wonderful things, so I hope that a lot of people who are listening will have the chance to listen to this more than once, because you've said so many good things. I want to thank you, Kate Wilson, founder of Nozick-Crowe, for talking to me today. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book business.